From the newsroom of WBUR, I'm Darryl C. Murphy. Welcome to Consider This from Boston. And we're joined today by WBUR's Gabriella Emanuel.
Hello.
Our esteemed senior health and science reporter. I have to ask you something.
Shoot, what is it?
All right. Earlier this summer, a major report came out of the National Academies about the toxic chemicals called PFAS. Or is it PFAS?
PFAS, I think, although every expert pronounces it differently.
Okay, so PFAS, the report recommended that people with significant exposure to these chemicals get a blood test and ongoing medical screening, and you found there's some complications around that, right?
Right.
Okay, so here is my question. What exactly is PFAS? I've been hearing about this chemical for some time now, and I am still wrapping my head around it.
You and the rest of us. PFAS is a class of man-made chemicals. There are literally thousands of them, and they are known as forever chemicals because they take so long to break down. They linger around. And these chemicals have been used, widely used, for the past 60 years. Manufacturers really like PFAS because they are good at repelling water, grease, stains. So they're useful for things like firefighting foams, but also raincoats, nonstick pans, cosmetics, makeup, floss, you name it,
Wait
it has
a minute.
PFAS.
Floss? I use
yes.
floss all the time. Do I have PFAS in my teeth?
Yes, you do. Not just in your teeth, but also in your blood. Basically, everyone has some level of exposure, and there are studies suggesting 98% of people have detectable levels of PFAS. So, yeah, it's in the rainwater, it's in the animals in the Arctic. A few years ago, the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection actually sampled 27 rivers across the state and found PFAS chemicals in all 27.
Man, you can't get away from it.
No, you really can't.
So what are the health consequences of being exposed to this class of chemicals now that I have this PFAS in my mouth?
Right. There are a whole host of problematic health concerns that have been linked to PFAS. So it goes from things that reduce your immune function, so your response to vaccines, to thyroid dysregulation, metabolism issues. Also a bunch of cancers like testicular cancer, breast cancer, kidney cancer.
Mm.
And these recommendations you were referencing earlier that came from the report from the National Academies is that a very large group of people should get blood tested. And this includes folks who don't even realize they've been exposed, like people who live near a commercial airport or a military base or a farm that's used sewage sludge.
Okay, so are there any immediate symptoms from PFAS exposure that people should look out for?
No, not really. This is much more of a long-term health issue.
Okay. Now, is it safe to assume that communities of color and low-income communities are likely to experience high PFAS exposure?
Not necessarily. So we are actually learning a lot about this as we go along. So there's new information basically every week. And we're even getting better at measuring PFAS at the right level. That's new. However, in Massachusetts, it is not necessarily linked to kind of low-income communities or communities of color. For example, Boston and the surrounding area that gets their water from the MWRA, they've actually been in a really good situation where they haven't found problematic levels of PFAS.
Mm.
And thus, other communities, for example, Wellesley, have had to turn to them for water to deal with their own PFAS issues. Cambridge just did this a few weeks ago. So, as you said, there are major sources of contamination. Those tend to be more like military bases where they've been using these firefighting foams and then it's seeped into the watershed, or a water treatment facility, a chemical manufacturer. So those are kind of the major sources. But you can also find some bottled water that has PFAS in it, some of those very fancy compostable containers. But then there is this kind of financial issue when you think about being exposed through a nonstick pan or fast food wrappers. There, it can be expensive to avoid PFAS.
Oh, man, that sounds really pervasive. Now, the recommendation is a blood test for those with high levels of exposure, but you've been reporting that it's not actually clear how to get this test.
Yes, exactly. So These tests are available. You can find direct-to-consumer options, as well as Quest now is doing these tests. But doctors, by and large, aren't aware of how to get these tests. It's not even in their computer ordering system for lab work. I spoke to Brita Lundberg about all of this. She's chair of the Environmental and Occupational Health Committees at the Massachusetts Medical Society. She says patients have begun asking for PFAS blood tests, but clinicians, she says, are at a real loss.
And I'm sure people are asking left and right to have this test, because we've had our own members approach us saying, what should we be doing here?
Yeah, there are a couple education efforts in the works. There is a continuing medical education class about PFAS that's about to launch. And there are experts compiling resources for doctors. This is kind of basic stuff, like what code do you use to order the test? And also how to talk to patients about it and explain this whole kind of new concept that's recently hit the general public. And Lundberg is also currently drafting a resolution, I should mention, about PFAS for the Massachusetts Medical Society that would, if it passes, allow them to advocate at the State House and with the American Medical Association on this issue. But there are also plenty of physicians that are not even aware of this issue. Here is Elsie Sunderland, who is an environmental chemist at Harvard. She's been studying this for a decade.
I don't think this is on the radar screen of most physicians. You know, even next to sites with PFAS contamination, I don't think like this is standard knowledge in the medical community.
So the bottom line here is that there is still a long way to go for doctors and clinicians.
Okay, so let's imagine a patient or doctor can find a test. What happens next?
Yes, there are a few key questions that you need to ask. The first is to make sure you are going through a reputable lab, since it is not easy to do a PFAS test. The second is you need to think about cost. A PFAS blood test can cost hundreds of dollars. And in New Hampshire, there's a law that requires major health insurers foot the bill. That is not the case here in Massachusetts. So I've seen tests for about $400. Yeah, not cheap.
Not cheap at all.
So Rose Goldman is a physician in occupational environmental medicine at the Cambridge Health Alliance, and she's actually helped some patients through this whole process. And she says there is a fundamental question hanging over it all.
If you get the test, then what do we do with this result?
Now, she says for the first time, the National Academies report gave her a way to link a test result to an actual kind of set of risks and give patients a sense of where things stand. But still, she says there is no treatment and her medical recommendation would likely be the same regardless of the test.
There's no way we can get this stuff out in any legitimate evidence-based way. So it's there. And the advice that we're going to give you is stop the exposure. Get a filter on your water. Stop drinking the water. Stop using the pan that's nonstick if you think that's the source.
Well, what I'm hearing from all of this is that there's a ways to go before, you know, doctors and experts really get an understanding of PFAS and how to deal with it.
Yes, there is a very long way to go. And I would add that Elsie Sunderland, the scientist from Harvard who we spoke about earlier, actually worries about all the attention that's now being paid to PFAS. She says on the one hand, it's good because this is a serious chemical, but she is concerned that it's kind of causing unnecessary worrying and that things are beginning to get muddled. She actually proposed a different way to think about it. She said, think about people and communities in two fundamental categories. First, the communities that are severely contaminated. She mentioned Hyannis in this, where there's already kind of action being taken. But in those severely contaminated communities, there what needs to happen is site remediation. And she said for the rest of us, for the general public, even though there's PFAS in our environments, she thinks that we should not be focused on kind of getting our blood tested, but instead we should be thinking about reducing future PFAS exposure and then advocating to reduce the production and use of these chemicals in general.
If we decide we don't want these products and they're not essential to the functionality of these products, we can get rid of them and immediately eliminate that pathway of exposure, and that will dramatically reduce exposures for the general population.
She thinks this is fundamentally achieved through regulation rather than blood work or medical monitoring for, you know, a broad sect of the population.
Gabriella, thank you so much for breaking this all down. I now have a better understanding of PFAS, and also I'm a little paranoid because I'm sure it's in my system.
Yes, join the club.
Yeah, but I have something else to ask you after we take a quick break, so please stick around. So, Gabriella, a lot of people like to wait for the autumn equinox to declare fall, but for me, it's fall after Labor Day, and fall is one of my favorite seasons. My mind is already on cooler weather, orange leaves. You know, I can't wait for it to get chillier. But we are still in this COVID-19 pandemic, and the colder months, especially winter, tend to bring an uptick in cases. Can you give us an update on where things are with COVID-19 and what to expect as we move into the colder seasons?
I wish I could. I mean, every expert I talk to really says they don't know exactly what the fall will look like. But as you said, cooler months mean people move indoors. We're seeing fewer and fewer masks, fewer precautions, especially in the schools. So I think it's safe to say there will be an uptick, but it's hard to know exactly what that will look like. Things are already kind of flat, but at a pretty high level when you look at the wastewater. In terms of COVID-19 in general, there is this booster campaign for the Omicron vaccine. This is a booster for the original vaccine that's actually specifically targeted to what is circulating right now, to the virus that's circulating. And that has just become available, literally, like yesterday, today. I just got my shot. And that
I need to get on that.
Yes, go. There are readily available appointments. And that has been predicted to save a bunch of lives heading into the winter.
Yeah, I definitely got to get on that booster vaccine for Omicron for sure. Gabriella, thank you so much for this. As always, it is truly a pleasure.
Thank you.
That's senior health and science reporter Gabriella Emanuel. And that's all for today. This episode was produced by Wilder Fleming. Our show is mixed by Emily Jankowski, Matt Reed, and Paul Vikas. Our editor is Ben Brock Johnson. And from the newsroom of WBUR, I'm your host, Daryl C. Murphy. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Do you want to feel more connected to your community? If so, you should check out Radio Boston, WBUR's local daily news magazine where the town hall meets the kitchen table. Radio Boston is a great way to stay connected to what's happening in our city and our region 5 days a week. Just search for Radio Boston on your favorite podcast app and hit subscribe.